Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We take a look at another popular archetype through the Jungian lens, the clown. References to the clown can be traced back throughout ancient cultures and indigenous tribes. Its ancestors are the fool and the jester. Another expression is the trickster that takes on dual energies of silliness and seriousness, play and work, and also creating and destroying. We talk with our guest, Michael Bala, about his article in the Jung journal, Culture and Psyche, titled The Clown, An Archetypal Self Journey. Michael is a certified Jungian analyst, and in the article, he discusses the historic psychological necessity of clowns and laughter, and how it has been woven into popular culture. We also look at the fear of clowns and the shadow side of this archetype. Michael describes the transforming process of becoming psychologically whole by embracing the clown archetype. Michael Bala is a licensed marriage and family therapist and earned a BA in the humanities from the New School University in New York and a master's in counseling psychology with a specialization in depth psychology from the Pacifica Graduate Institute near Santa Barbara. Michael, welcome to Another News.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for doing this. I want to ask you first, where is the clown on the Jungian archetype map?
Well, yeah, archetypes can take many forms. And I think about archetypes as patterns of energy emerging from the collective unconscious. Some forms, like the king or queen or the savior or devil or child, and I think the clown or the clownish trickster is one of those archetypes. And I think of archetypes as these forms as personifications or humanized expressions of really powerful collective unconscious forces seeking some conscious awareness or relationship. I think of clowns, really, I experience clowns and clowning as an expression or manifestation of that trickster archetype. And as Carl Jung wrote, I think it was in his Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious, he wrote, quote, "The trickster is a collective shadow figure, a summation of all the inferior traits of character in individuals." And for me, getting in touch with some of my inferior traits was through clowning, through very conscious clowning.
In your article, you describe how you personally went through the transformation, which I want to get to, but I want to ask you about the psychology of laughter. You talk about that in your article, and what is the significance of the unconscious process when people laugh?
Well, let me frame that a little bit in physiology, what's happening when people laugh in their bodies, and then move on to what may be happening as an unconscious process.
Mm-hmm.
So when we laugh, especially when we have those full-body belly laughs, we breathe in more deeply, we take in more oxygen, our heart rate increases, our blood flows. In laughter, our bodies actually release endorphins and dopamine. And with laughter, our bodies also release less cortisol. More interferon and T-cells are produced. So the body is actually having quite a set of responses and reactions to laughter. And in recent years, neuroscience has looked at something called mirror neurons that respond in kind to the information our senses take in. So when we see somebody laugh, we're primed to laugh ourselves. Laughter is contagious. So I also think of laughter as an engagement with the other. That which is not necessarily our either known self or our persona. And it's a way in which we get to see the other and we get to experience ourselves in relationship to the other. So there is that aspect. I think with laughter, research has found that creativity is increased. There's increased ability to do problem solving. Ability to cope with stress is improved. Depression and anxiety are reduced. There's an elevation of mood. And there's greater hope and self-esteem. Nearly 100 years ago, Freud wrote that humor, as a defense mechanism, which of course it can be, he proposed that humor fends off the possibility of suffering. And he placed humor among that great series of methods that the human mind is constructed to evade the compulsion to suffer. So Freud thought of that as a pretty rare and precious gift for humans. And I've thought about clowning as a kind of play, playing around with what is uncomfortable, improper, or not quite so known, and as an avenue of psychological development. So I think when we are playing, what's happening in our unconscious is there's a freedom. Anything can be explored. Nothing is forbidden. Where our egos and our superegos, or if we stay with the Freudian language for a moment, might not allow. So I think unconsciously there's a release, there's a freedom, especially if there's also laughter and all those biological things are occurring. I think laughter and play promote creativity. The imagination and fantasy come into engagement, and then anything is possible, at least in play. So I think laughter is related to play often, not always, of course.
In your article, you described your transforming process of embracing the clown archetype, and you joined a clown school.
Yes.
Can you tell listeners about that process and how that shaped your understanding of playing? Is that something missing in our culture?
Well, I think the play often is missing in our culture. We've become, in many ways, a pretty cerebral and somewhat disconnected culture. We can go online and we can text and all those things. And play often becomes, games on the computer. So I think play is essential. So let me frame about how I came to studying the clown and talk about that from a personal perspective, and maybe that'll help answer your question. So I'm stepping back. I had worked in financial management services for a number of years, and then started working both in Miami and in San Francisco, where I live now, working in AIDS services for the public health department. And I did that work for a number of years, and I became increasingly tired and exhausted because I was working so much. And I was sitting in a cafe one day and flipping through a local newspaper, and I saw this ad for something called the Clown School. And immediately, my intuition said, oh, there's something there for me. I didn't quite know what that meant. So I went and discovered that this program was to develop a character and let the character emerge from within ourselves. So there was a lot of physical movement, playing with a potential piece of a character that might come out, allowing the unconscious process to unfold and be presented there in group in a pretty safe environment. So I realized that what had been missing in my life for many years was play, because my life was very serious. I was doing AIDS work. I was managing, previous to that, I was managing monies, finances. And I realized I had never really had the opportunity as a child and as an adult to just be playful. And I felt creative and stultified. So I joined this clown school. I went there for a number of years, 2 or 3 years, I'm not quite sure. And I began to realize that I was doing something that Jung had called an active imagination. I was playing with something. I was giving it shape and form that I could then think about and integrate. So for me, going to clown school was a great sense of freedom to not have to be my serious self all the time. And I discovered many things, including some of those inferior traits that I got to give some body movement to and voice to. So I actually think in some ways going to con school was actually one of the best things I'd ever done in my life for myself.
Is there a substitute experience that somebody might have instead of going to clown school? What other possibilities are there for people to engage that part of their psychology?
Well, you know, I made a reference to active imagination. That's a method that Carl Jung promoted and developed and promoted, where we work with material that's coming up from our unconscious. We give it shape and form. Maybe it's art as and writing, as I think he did with his Red Book. And then in doing so, our conscious minds, our egos, can then look at that material, work with it, and make some relationship to this unconscious material. And that can be done in therapy, in analysis, but it doesn't need to be done in analysis. I think when people give themselves freedom to express in some concrete form, painting, sculpting, movement or dance, writing, we get some distance from the material itself. We can look at that material and see how it fits in our own psychology, or discover that there are parts of ourselves that we weren't very familiar with, and we begin to develop a relationship with those things.
Yes, and I think it's a very interesting process that could be valuable for people. When you you look at where you were and where you're at now, what significant changes can you pinpoint?
Well, I think through my playing at clowning, and I didn't think I was going to go anywhere with it. I was just playing. I was just having fun. At first. And then I began to realize that this was really meaningful for me. And I began to think about what did I want to do with my life? I really didn't want to do that particular kind of work anymore, financial management or designing or developing AIDS programs. Well, that was satisfying, and I felt I was pretty good at it, but I was really... I was being called to do something else. My soul needed something. And in that process, I began to think about, what would I do with the rest of my life? And I sat there one day, and I said, oh, I want to become a Jungian analyst. Well, I wasn't even a psychotherapist at the time. That led me to go to graduate school, become a psychotherapist, become a marriage and family therapist. And then after a few more years, apply to become, for training in as a Jungian analyst, and then becoming certified as a Jungian analyst. And so for me, entering that door to the clown school actually started a whole process, a whole pathway that began to emerge. And I began to feel more whole and full and complete, because I think both my mind and my soul were engaged.
Oh, it's a great story. I love hearing these types of breakthroughs through integration of something like playing. And maybe it wasn't in your childhood, but you got in contact with it and then brought it back into your life. So,
yes.
And it was a missing piece. So that's really interesting. But your article, you go into some really interesting points about the myths and legends and stories of the functions of clowns and Native American stories as well. There are many tribes you've mentioned, the Navajo, the Pueblo, the Hopi, the Zuni, have these myths of the trickster and the trickster role. Can you talk about that, what's going on with that in indigenous cultures?
Yes. Well, as I became more and more interested and curious about the clown, I began to actually begin to do some research and wondering what was out there about the clown, the trickster. And I got in touch with the clown and the fool and jesters. And I began to read about how these characters functioned in societies, some going way, way back, hundreds, thousands of years. And I came across some information about the ritual clowns in certain Native American cultures, traditions. And in large part, the clowns play a disruptive role to the propriety of the, that's inherent in the sacred traditions. And in that disruptive role, there is often laughter, and that releases something that paradoxically actually supports the sacred rituals. It reminds people that they're human, or would remind people that they're human. They emerged from chaos, and chaos could easily reassert itself despite these sacred rituals, which were more about cosmology and ordering. And I think they're clowns in behaving disorderly, in fact, focused on order and form and structure and the importance of that in the traditional culture. And the clowns would often, you know, they would do like take bites of old blankets and chew on scraps of wood and might bite off the heads of mice or toss urine on each other. And they're actually showing the dark side of life as it's played out, even while the sacred rituals are being played out. They highlighted that disorder exists with order, that the divine and the human are absolutely linked. The sacred and the profane coexist. Clowns would play at the edges of what was proper. And in doing so, they highlighted what could be a one-sided sacred approach or traditional cultural approach that didn't always allow for disruption, for the chaos that is inherent in cult, in our lives.
It's amazing that that was the role, one of the roles of that particular archetype in these indigenous cultures. It's one of the names of them, if I got this right, is the Winnebago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Winnebago tribe. We see RVs named after these things. You know, mm-hmm. We have this tendency in American culture to appropriate names and apply them to
weapons,
consumer products. But yes, there's a Winnebago tribe, and the clowns, who were also seen as sacred, played a very important cultural role. It was a necessary balancing to the sacred, which could feel very one-sided and all about, you know, rules and law and order and prescription. And the clown said, yeah, but, you know, there's also this, that we come from a disruptive place. You know, we begin that way in life. Our cultures began that way and could easily return that way if, you know, the rain didn't come or some population invaded their territory. They kept a kind of balancing, because any one-sidedness, it can be stultifying.
Indeed, absolutely. Any rigid dogma can be taken too far. You pointed out that there are many functions the clown has served through cultures, including religious, even by questioning the existence of God or an object of worship. Can you talk about that function?
Yes. Well, continuing what I was saying about clowns in the indigenous cultures of the Americas, I recall reading a definition of religion that I found in a critical dictionary of Jungian analysis. And it defined religion as an attitude of mind, a careful consideration and observation of certain powers, such as spirits, demons, gods, laws, ideals. And it went further to talk about religion as an attitude towards whatever impresses us sufficiently so that we're moved to worship or obedience or reverence or love. And so I began to think about clowns and clowning from these indigenous cultures, but also from cultures throughout the centuries, and what function did they play in the religious? So when a society becomes very ingrained, very rigid, as you pointed out, that balance is needed. And I think the clowns began to do that. Because when there's no space for the questioning, we've seen where heretics and witches in the past have, you know, what has happened to them. So I think the clowns have functioned as a release of a kind of one-sided tension of propriety. And I think clowning also provided, you know, going back to what Freud said about humor and other psychologists have said about humor and play and imagination, is they challenge certainties and the certainties of God and God as an object of worship. They're a compensatory function to the saint, to the hero, to the goodly. Clowns serve as a kind of advocate to the diabolical, to the improper. And they look goodness straight in the face and say, oh, yeah, watch me. There's more than just goodness going on here. The clowns show us the other side of things with their mockery and their buffoonery and silly dress and frantic behavior. Clowns challenge perfection. And I think clowns as an archetype, the archetype of clown and trickster, carries that religious function by referring us back to earlier states of chaotic being, to primitive states, and points out the foibles of humankind. And the clown reminds us that we are indeed human, even as we look to God or the gods for comfort or solace and guidance. And that saintliness is, if we can look at it that way, is one way, but it's really hard to be saintly all the time. That's just not how we're made up as human beings. So it questioned, I think the clowns brought the question, is everything really good? How do we really deal with when hardship happens, when pain and suffering happens? That there's this other side that most religious traditions, I believe, certainly the traditions of the Middle East, Judaism, Catholicism, and I think maybe to some degree Islam, talk about the goodness. God is goodness. And the clowns, I think, began to represent the diabolical that also coexists in the world and gave some form and expression for that. In that way, actually, maybe containing it.
I didn't think about that aspect. By expressing it, it becomes a container also.
Yes. Anything that can't be expressed becomes either suppressed or repressed, and it goes back into the unconscious, and it will find its way out if not given an avenue. And then it can become, you know, it gets played out. We sort of act things out. Societies can become, in some ways, dangerous when we don't hold what is unconscious, try to hold what's unconscious as consciously as we can, that these forces absolutely are strong and they need to be treated with respect. And that may be giving them a form, an expression.
Our guest is Michael Balla. We're talking about his article, The Clown, An Archetypal Self-Journey. Michael, you referenced the contemporary clowns such as Howdy Doody, Clarabelle, Ronald McDonald, Homie the Clown, Krusty the Clown, and I would add in there Clowns in the Circus, although that's not very contemporary, but they exist. How would you describe their evolution from past incarnations of clowns, and what could we, as the viewers of this entertainment, be projecting onto them?
Yes, well, I laugh a little as you frame them as contemporary, which I probably did myself in my article, because in some ways, some of those clowns are from my childhood. So I suppose that's contemporary, but it's not more immediate. And so I think some clowns represent what's endearing, silly, harmless, playful, maybe even helpful figures, as some of those clowns, Howdy Doody and Clarabelle. And they're something we can take delight in and laugh at. And so those can be some characteristics of a certain kind of clown. But clowns can also be very sharp-tongued, biting the hand that feeds them, really pointing out the inequities of the world. So clowns are not all lovable and delightful. And clowns, like all archetypal figures, can change and take new forms. With cultural development, shifts in consciousness, archetypal figures can lose power, or they can simply transform. I think clowns began way back when in the fools of the royal courts and jesters, and they may have fallen, those kinds of trickster characters, fallen more into the shadows of history. We don't have royal courts in the same way. And I think that transformed into figures on television and into movies. And they often play a very specific role in a storyline. And I think the core of that role is to offer or to provide something that's missing and move the story forward in a certain way and add a kind of dramatic tension. And as I said, clowns can have a very dark side. And I think when the dark side of humanity doesn't get free rein to be experienced and expressed in safe ways, that it goes underground, becomes unconscious, and can emerge in all kinds of malevolent ways. And I think those more malevolent clowns that we see also may be an expression of the darker aspects of humanity, of the darker sides of our psyches, the shadowy material that's seeking a way to be known. And so that we know ourselves more fully, more wholly, when we deal with our own shadow material also. And I think that's part of what I was doing when I went to clown school. I had to look at the enshadowed aspects of myself that I didn't want to look at, or just never had took the time to look at.
Our guest is Michael Balla. We're talking about his article titled "The Clown, An Archetypal Self-Journey." We'll be right back after this break. you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Michael Balla about the archetype function of the clown. Do you want to share what came up for you? Because that's a couple years in clown school and might inspire someone to go.
Well, it might. I encourage people to do whatever their interest, what might grab at them and grip them, and follow that, but and see where that might lead them. See how it might be for development, but it just might be a great way to play and enjoy. But some of what came up for me, now, keeping the frame is that I, you know, here I was, this very competent professional working in financial management services and then developing AIDS programs and managing AIDS programs and in fact, managing a very, very sizable budget for the city and county of San Francisco. So I in many ways, I was part of the establishment. And some parts of me were just not getting expression. Like, I couldn't be foolish. I couldn't be unsure in certain ways. You know, I felt I had to know what I was doing. And I discovered there's parts of myself that didn't have a clue what was going on. And didn't know how the world actually operated and functioned. And one of the things my clown character discovered was rolls of toilet paper. And it became this magical object, not unlike those brooms that the Sorcerer's Apprentice in that Disney movie, they, you know, casts a spell and they come alive and doesn't know how to stop them. Well, that's a scary aspect of that material. In clown school, I got to play with these parts of myself that were just kind of stupid and dumb and oafish. And in playing with them, I didn't have to be them. I could engage with them in a new way and look at them. So my clown character, picking up the toilet paper again, found that this object had a mind of its own. And here I was, my character's name is Buster Bagawind, and he had to begin to relate to this object that could fly through the air on its own and chase after it and be silly and be confused and befuddled. And that was a really important thing for me to connect with in myself.
I think it could help a lot of people, I suppose. And while you were describing taking a look at maybe shadow aspects of yourself, it's a great way to do it. I think some people are afraid to look foolish, and coming to terms with that, it might be really freeing in some way.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. I think probably most of us don't want to look foolish or feel foolish. It feels so humiliating and embarrassing, and of course we want to protect against that. And yet, there are times when we don't know what's going on, and we say strange things or foolish things, those sort of Freudian slips that come out of our mouth, and we go, "Oh my God, where did that come from?" Well, that's something to pay attention to. Where did that come from? What is that about? And I think finding ways to engage, to discover parts of ourselves and to engage with those parts so that we're really looking at wholeness. Because if we cut off the parts that are uncomfortable to know or feel foolish or unformed, kind of lumpen, it's not a sense of wholeness. So I think my clowning was really about coming into contact with parts of myself that I didn't know very well. Some of them were really dumb and embarrassing. And getting to play with that in a very creative way, but not identifying with it. I think that was the important part, is not identifying, not thinking of myself as stupid or foolish or something like that, but that I could have those aspects in me and give them voice or expression, actually not much voice, because my clown character is silent. He doesn't speak. He's very embodied in that sense, which was also really important for me, to be able to make use of my body and move around. So I really encourage people to find whatever avenue sounds right for them, is to explore those parts of themselves, to discover and then explore those parts of themselves which are probably less comfortable knowing about. I think analysis is very much about that, but I think play is also about that.
Yes, you said something interesting about, if I got this right, you got to be careful not to link up these negative aspects of looking foolish up to your identity and who you are.
Yes. We don't want to identify with them, but to recognize, I'm a human being. Of course I might have parts of myself that, you know, I learned to be civilized or proper, or, you know, I learned all those lessons that my mom and dad told me, you know, behave well and all of that. You know, I learned those things really, really well. Well, what about the parts of me that don't behave very well? But they aren't me. They're just aspects of me. So it's about holding the multiplicity of ourselves. Our psyches are so multiple. They're not singular. That's the trouble with, you know, becoming ego-identified. It seems like that's all I am. I think all of us are much more than we seem, certainly on the surface.
You mentioned the dark side of clowns and the shadow aspect, which this area in terms of entertainment, stories, novels, movies, it seems endless. And Stephen King's novel titled It was among the very first to bring the scary clown to a wide audience. I think it came out in 1986, the book did. The story is about a malevolent, shape-shifting entity known only as It, and it terrorizes a small town in Maine. It lives in the sewers and takes on the form of a cheerful clown named Pennywise. A couple more examples of the dark side of clowns include the Joker in the Batman series, John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer dressed up as a clown. You referenced the clown in the film Poltergeist, which was in a jack-in-the-box form. And then there are the news reports last year of clowns in full costume being spotted at night under overpasses in Staten Island and other locations. What is happening here within the clown archetype and our projection of fear?
Yes. Well, I've wondered the same thing, and I pose that in my article. What's happening to the clown? Has he? And I often refer to the clowns as he. I don't think they're just he's. They're female clowns also. But my experience is the clowns as he have gone underground. And so here, I think that Stephen King is actually really connecting with something that this figure called It resides in the sewers. And the refuse, you know, the has refuge in the sewers, and that it's all that stuff we try to get rid of and not seen and get rid, you know, send it away, but that there's life there, and that life in the dark, in the shadow, in the expelled, continues, and if we don't pay attention to it, it can pop up. I also think that the clown being called Pennywise, I mean, penny is the lowest denomination we have, the monetary denomination we have. So it's not worth a lot, but it's Pennywise. It really evokes something in our psyches. So I think these figures that you mentioned, Pennywise and the Joker in Batman, and and the clown in Poltergeist that was a jack-in-the-box, I think they are expressions of that which has been held back and enshadowed. And it is finding an avenue, a vehicle, through the clown to present itself so that we can see it and relate to it, and that it is also can also be frightening. And I think part of what's happening, and I think with those clown figures that show up in the middle of the night, as you say, in Staten Island and other places, it was also here in California a year or so ago, I think it's a reminder that there are the darker aspects that can suddenly pop up. And it's the unknown that pops up, because the clown in his makeup and costume is something out of the ordinary that can just pop right up, and it's dark and it's unsettling and it's frightening, and that we have to be in contact with that part of our psyches and our culture also. And if not, it'll show up in some form or another. So I actually think these figures are really to be appreciated. They're offering awareness. They're promoting awareness of the darker side of things that can also be really, really frightening.
Michael, by covering up your face with a mask or with paint and exploring alter egos or personas, I've heard there's a potential for the shadow aspect to gain footing. A path is created for the expression of repressed energies that could manifest into the negative. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes. Let me tell you a story about, I was doing a presentation, a public presentation on clowning. And I was, you know, being very academic, but I also had incorporated a transformation from my regular street clothes self to Buster Bagawind. And in front of the audience that I was presenting to, I began to transform by getting into costume and putting on my clown makeup. And my clown makeup, fairly simple and traditional, it's white face, exaggerated black eyebrows and a red nose and red lips. And a really close friend of mine was in the audience this time I was presenting, and she knew about my clown work, but she'd never actually seen it. And she said that as I was transforming, she became very frightened in herself, but also for me, that I, the Michael she knew, was disappearing, and something else was taking over. And that my whole body, she said, began to transform, and I became more fixed in the character. And that she found that disturbing and frightening, and feared what I disappear and never be able to come back with this makeup, this figure, take over. Now, I think it didn't for me, because I did these years of what I call a very multiple years of active imagination and playing with and relating to the clown in a very structured environment in the clown school, and then took it out into the world and presented it. I think if we don't have strong enough egos, or we're in some period in our lives where life is chaotic and we're very stressed out, I think these energies can take over, and we need support and around that, so that we don't get consumed or subsumed by the darker evil aspects, which are in us, but they aren't necessarily who we are. We don't have to identify with them. So for me, it was about playing with it and expressing it, as opposed to getting so lost in the figure that I felt taken over by it. There is that risk. And I encourage people to really, if they're going to find some avenue, whether it's clowning or something else, that really is about exploring the darker aspects of the psyche and of themselves and of their personal history and their and the collective unconscious, is to really get a good support system around that, whether it's a good therapist or an analyst or family members or colleagues or friends who provide some counterbalance and can, you know, talk it through and gain perspective on, maintain perspective on it. And that's really essential. So I think there are risks being consumed by the dark. And we've seen that happen. Maybe your reference to John Wayne Casey is an example where the dark takes over.
Yes, your story reminded me of a film that came out last year. I think it was called Clowned. Maybe it was called Clowned, where the main character is supposed to be at an event entertaining children. And for some reason, he finds this clown costume, puts it on, and he can't take it off. It's glued to his body, and he becomes to turn into the evil clown, which I thought was another great deep psychological plot, I guess, or script, tapping into these energies again. But I wanted to ask you, about the clothing of the clown. The mimes, the Harlequin, the Joker, the court jester, they have a wide range of patterns and colors, but fairly consistent throughout the ages. And I wondered why that is, and can you talk about the costume of the clown?
Sure. The costume is often called the motley, M-O-T-L-E-Y. And, motley is a kind of a thrown together, it's a hearkening back. It could be a kind of, uniform that's a sign of the role that the character is playing. Immediately when you see somebody who's dressed in this kind of way, it's out of the ordinary. It may feel, based in antiquity because it has all this history, but it's out of the ordinary. You immediately know that something non-usual is happening or about to happen. And I think that's an important aspect of the clown's costume. Well, there may be variation, but inevitably it's kind of shabby or it's very stylized. And we are already transported, or we begin to be transported into another space and time by seeing that. And it's an invitation to join in and wait and see what's coming up, to have an experience that, is pretty atypical of our regular normal lives. We don't usually see people running around in clown costumes, maybe Halloween or, certain kinds of parties but that's situation specific. So the clown is telling us something in the costume. Pay attention. Something's going on here.
Well, Michael, can you tell listeners about your work as a therapist?
Well, as I said, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I'm a certified Jungian analyst. And so people come to me here in my office in San Francisco. I'm in private practice. And I work with a number of people on lots of issues, and sometimes they want to do analytic work, and sometimes they have life problems that they begin to want, they want to sort out and listen to. And when I'm doing analytic work, there's a lot of dream work, a lot of work with myths. People really, I think, looking for what is their personal myth, what story are they living, and are they actually living the story that makes sense to them, that is about their fullness and their wholeness. People coming wanting to grow and individuate and develop and be as full a person as they can be. I employ expressive arts. I have art materials here if people want to draw or paint something that where the words don't quite capture it. And I have Sand Tray in my office. It's where tray of sand, where people take objects that are on my shelves, figures, objects, and they create stories and worlds. And usually it's done nonverbally. And it's about connecting with their material from their deep unconscious and giving it shape and form so that it can be looked at, that sand tray. So I work in a lot of different ways, and I really try to approach it as, you know, who is this person sitting across from me, and what are they seeking? Why are they here? And can I help them along that path? That's why I became a Jungian analyst, knowing that in the depths there's such a richness of material that is calling for exploration and integration. And some of it is dark. And some of it isn't. All shadow material isn't necessarily dark and scary. The shadow can also be light. I had a dream a number of years ago, before I went to clown school, where I was in a large house, and I was up on the second floor in a bedroom, and I heard a noise downstairs, and I heard some figure running up the stairs. And as I stood in the doorway of the bedroom, this figure came running by me, just completely black shape, almost like somebody was in a body stocking. Could make out features, but it was just shadowy. And the figure looked at me, and I looked at it as it ran down the hallway, and it ran right through the side of the building and out. And I was dumbstruck in the dream. And I immediately knew who the figure was. And the figure was joyful abandon. And I began to get in touch with some of my shadow material that might be joyful abandon. And that ultimately, a few years later, led me to the clown school and led me to then go on to train and become certified as a Jungian analyst. That there's material in the shadow that's worth paying attention to.
Well, Michael Balla, I really appreciate you sharing this information, not only about the article you wrote several years ago, but also what you're doing now.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure to talk about the clown.
We're going to keep following some of the topics on clowns in upcoming shows, and I'll send you links to those, see what you think.
That'd be great. I think the more we can talk about these things and have a dialogue and different perspectives, I think it just enriches us all.
Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
You're welcome, and thank you very much.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again on Dark Matter Radio. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information and links to the guests.